Welcome back to our continuing podcast, CCW Safe. Hi, I'm Don West, National Trial Counsel. And with me, as always, for these lively discussions on significant cases involving self-defense issues is media relations and litigation consultant Sean Vincent.
Hey, what's happening, Don?
Hi. Good to see you again.
Always a pleasure. So we've been talking, these last three episodes were high-profile cases that involved home defense.
Right.
So we've talked about Marcus Karma in Montana. We talked about Byron David Smith in Minnesota. And we talked about Ted Wafer in Michigan.
Michigan, right.
Yeah. And for everyone listening, we're going to talk about these cases. We're going to summarize them for you. But you can find an in-depth discussion on each one of these at ccwsafe.com/podcasts. And I've written up a detailed series of articles about each of these cases that can be found at ccwsafe.com/blog.
That's right. So today will be a bit of a summary and assessment of how these cases may fit together with common themes and lessons to be learned with the overall perspective of home defense issues.
Sure. And one of the reasons I was excited to do this series is because talking to concealed carriers or to gun owners who are concerned with home defense is that there's an overriding attitude that if somebody invades your home, if somebody breaks into your house, that you have automatic justification to use deadly force to stop that. And what we found with these three cases is that that's not always the case.
You know, I think that that's a very good point. And maybe, I don't know how common the misperception is, but it's clearly a misunderstanding of the law if you think that simply because someone comes into your home, that person is, that it's open season on that person. Certainly, your home is your castle, and you have perhaps more rights and certainly more leeway in defending your home against an intruder. But the law simply doesn't allow you to shoot and kill anyone who crosses your threshold under any circumstances. There are clearly some presumptions in the homeowner's favor, presumptions that the intruder intended harm, serious harm or death, which allows one to use deadly force.
So what you're saying is if someone breaks into your house, there's a great assumption that they're not there to do you good.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. And that's usually a creature of statute. That's the legislature and the various jurisdictions saying, we will create these presumptions so that it further protects the homeowner that when someone comes into their home uninvited, that they are there for some bad reason. And even notwithstanding a direct threat, the presumption is in favor of defense.
Right.
However, those are rebuttable presumptions. And that if you confront someone in your house and you realize that they are not a threat, you certainly don't have the right to use deadly force in that scenario. And we can come up with all sorts of different twists on that idea of who might be in your home that
would why they'd be there.
Sure, and not pose a threat.
Sure, and I suppose you, like me, often get thrown scenarios, hypothetical scenarios. What if this happened? What if that happened? Could I, should I, must I use deadly force in that situation? But here's what we have. We have three actual real scenarios with real fact patterns that perhaps the shooters never would have anticipated when they first purchased their weapon. So it's a good exercise to run through these. So I'll take a minute and we'll summarize each one of these. Like I said, the audience can go back and listen to these conversations in depth on the website. But we'll start with Marcus Karma out in Minnesota. Not Minnesota. Marcus Karma was out in Montana, right? He lived in a suburban neighborhood. His garage had been broken into about 2 weeks before the shooting. And what he didn't necessarily know is that some of the local teenagers in the neighborhood, including this foreign exchange student, were into garage hopping. They'd go sneak into people's garages and steal beers out of their garage refrigerators. So what happens here is a perfect storm. Marcus Karma is upset about the robbery that had occurred to him before.
Right. These are basically a series of property crimes. There's no knowledge that I'm aware of connected with any of these incidents that anyone was directly assaulted or confronted or harmed in some way. But there was a series of break-ins resulting in property being stolen.
Sure, and a real sense of violation.
Without question.
Sure. Right. Mm-hmm. So Marcus sets up a video baby monitor in his garage so he can see into the garage. He's got the, you know, the video monitor inside so he can see it. It's motion activated so he knows. He actually has a shotgun that he keeps loaded by his front door. And he had telegraphed to a couple of people, including his hairdresser, the lady who cuts his hair, that if someone breaks in again, he's going to get those kids.
He's ready for him this time.
He's ready for him this right. time. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens. One night he sees a figure in the garage. It's after midnight. He thinks it's on. He grabs a shotgun. He goes out the front door, goes around to the front of the house where the garage is opened, and he fires into the garage.
And the garage door had already been opened on purpose earlier.
Well, yeah, that's what happened at trial, is they contended mm-hmm. that he had left the garage open to lure the burglar back. There's some suggestion that he even planted a purse with some old expired credit cards and things on the trunk mm-hmm. To lure somebody back. So that's Marcus Karma, right? He shot three times into the darkness. He struck the foreign exchange student twice. One was a fatal shot, and he died in his garage.
Yeah, critical aspects of this case that distinguish it perhaps from what one might think in terms of protecting your home against intruders is he set it up in a sense. He made it an attractive opportunity for someone who was interested in stealing beer or other things from the garage. And as you mentioned before, he announced early on his plan was to catch the people, and he had armed himself for that purpose, making it pretty clear that anyone he caught was going to get shot and likely killed.
Sure. And in fact, a law enforcement officer who lived in the neighborhood told them that with their dark garage door open at night, that they had made their home a target of opportunity.
If I'm not mistaken, wasn't Mr. Karma surprised when he actually got arrested and really surprised when he was prosecuted for murder? Is he a guy who really thought that was okay? That you can, in fact, shoot and kill anyone that happens to be caught on your property?
Yes. I think he believed that was okay. There's some little things where maybe he didn't. He tried to, this is very common, he tried to embellish his story a little bit. He suggested he heard metal dragging on concrete and that he had imagined some object flying out at him.
That sounds like an after-the-fact justification for something after he became concerned that maybe his first idea wasn't going to fly.
Yeah, and we're going to see that in the Wafer case, where a comment afterwards is clearly an attempt to reinforce what he felt was otherwise already justified self-defense. But it has the effect of muddying his credibility with investigators and then ultimately a jury. But I want to talk on this idea about the luring of somebody into your home with the idea that you're going to extract some revenge on them. And there's no case that's more clear than in the Byron David Smith case.
Yes.
Here's a man who lived alone in a little town called Little Falls, Minnesota. He was a veteran of the Air Force. He had worked for the State Department. He'd been a Boy Scout leader at some point in his life. But now he's here. He had reported about a month before the break-in that involved the shooting that he had been broken into, and they got away with some gold pieces that he owned, his medals from his service in the Air Force
in
Vietnam.
It's a property of value, both financial and sentimental,
sure,
as I recall.
Exactly. And he had resorted to carrying a pistol in a holster, just walking around his house, doing chores. He didn't feel safe in his own home. He had security cameras that filmed outside of his property, and it's Thanksgiving Day, and he notices these two teenagers casing his house, right? Now, important to mention, he had parked his car down the street that day. The prosecutor said to make it look like he wasn't home. He had some other excuse for he was cleaning out his garage or something while he had parked down the street.
But he was making his place attractive, it sounds like, to somebody on the outside, thinking that it was ripe for the taking and unlikely that somebody would be home.
Sure, and it worked. People did think that nobody was home. He actually went downstairs to his basement where he had a chair set up with a rifle and a pistol and a book and some water and some power bars. The prosecutor at trial said it might remind hunters of a deer stand. And he sat there and he waited for first the young man to come down the stairs. He shot him a couple of times. He stumbled down the stairs and then, still alive, lying on the basement floor, he shot him in the face through his outward extended hand.
So Smith was not just lying in wait. He had prepared to do that for an extended period of time. Didn't he have some provisions and even some entertainment, a book to read?
Yeah, exactly.
He was waiting for whoever it was to find him accidentally, but he was prepared, and his objective seemed to be right from the beginning, to confront them violently, and did in fact shoot without any warning or any attempt to ascertain what anything more than the fact that these kids were in his house.
That's right. And it had been several minutes since the first teen broke in, and he never called the police to report that he'd been broken into.
The first teenager down the steps was a young man, as I recall.
That's right.
And he was shot and not killed, and was shot again before the wounds were lethal.
That's right. He was shot as he's coming down the stairs, tumbled down the stairs, and then was still alive when he took the final shot.
Well, that's a critical aspect of any claimed self-defense scenario, is that you can only defend yourself to the point that the threat is neutralized. And I don't know how one would justify this kid being a threat in fact, although the circumstances where he entered the home without permission may favor the homeowner up to a point, but certainly after the first shot and the kid was no longer able to be a threat, completely then transforms what you might at least be able to argue was home defense or self-defense.
Sure.
Maybe even if the jury didn't accept a complete defense, may see it as mitigation and perhaps may reduce the level of an offense from murder to manslaughter. At the point that he continues to shoot after rendering the kid helpless, he converts whatever it was before into a clear murder.
Sure. And now to compound the situation, he wraps this kid up in a tarp, drags him to a dark corner of his basement, sits back down in his chair, and reloads. And it's 10 minutes later that the female cousin, comes in the house looking for him. She had been trying to call his cell phone, and of course he wasn't answering. So she wanders around upstairs, she comes downstairs, and the same scenario plays out again. Except for this time, after he shoots her first and she tumbles down the stairs, when he goes to finish her off, his gun jams, and his rifle jams, and he says, "Oh, I'm sorry," and he goes and he gets his pistol, and he shoots her underneath her chin, execution style, while she's essentially begging for her life. And we know this because he recorded the whole thing on an audio recorder.
Even more compelling evidence, making it absolutely clear that his goal was to take the life of both of these people. And under the most clear circumstances you could get, I suppose, for the girl, and that is that she was clearly incapacitated and was begging for her life. And his decision was, rather than to reassess the situation, to conclude she couldn't possibly be a threat, he chose to murder her.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's hard to pick a lesson exactly from that, other than that's a pretty clear case of murder. Do you think it's possible that Byron Smith thought any part of that was okay? Did it go from a guy who was upset about break-ins, who was trying to protect himself and his property, to the point that it became calculated murder.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I doubt that that scenario played out exactly how he had planned it, right? Because the heroes, in fact, when we posted this article, this series of articles on and promoted them on the CCWSA Facebook page, near the end of it, somebody wrote in and said, "I don't know why we're talking about this. This is clearly murder," right? Which is, I think, the point that we were trying to make, right? If we're going to look at these home invasion cases with the perspective of what are the limits of deadly force when it comes to home invasion, this case broadly and clearly crosses every red line that we might have.
Well, that's a really interesting point. Let me take just a minute and talk about the spectrum of these home invasion cases that you've called them. A burglary, we'll start with a burglary. A burglary typically is someone of a dwelling, is someone entering the home without permission for the purpose of committing another crime. Usually that crime is theft. So right. You break in, they want to steal something. Because it's a house, it becomes a much more serious crime than if it were a business or if it were just stealing something off the front yard, out of the front yard. So that is typically, jumping into the mind of the burglar for a moment, that is typically by design to be a non-confrontational event. Most of the burglars don't want anybody at home. In fact, some of them will ring doorbells and do other things to try to determine that there's no one home because they're not looking for a confrontation.
Right.
And then there are, of course, what becomes a burglary gone bad in some sense, and that is people that are not expecting a confrontation. They might be drug addicts or just petty thieves that are looking for an easy steal of some sort, but not looking for a physical confrontation. And of course, they picked the wrong house. And that's what this seems to be, that they picked the wrong house and that they probably weren't looking to confront anyone, to harm anyone. They were there to steal things.
So they were, in fact, unarmed.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And probably had no idea that there was anybody home. And it looks as though Byron Smith took some steps to be sure they thought there was no one home. He was quiet when they came in. He'd parked his car down the street, did nothing to make them aware that there was anybody home and they would have expect a confrontation. He probably didn't want them to run off because he wanted to end it this time. But none of that is to be confused with home invasion robbery. And I think that's an entirely different category of crime when it's clear that the purpose of the assailants, of the attackers, are to break into some place to confront the occupants and steal things. Maybe it's a robbery of valuables, maybe it's a robbery of drugs, suspected drug dealers. They break into the house and it could be a sexual assault of some sort. Mm-hmm. But with that in mind, that's the category of criminal that goes in there on purpose to confront somebody and steal what they have.
Sure.
And yet, you know, defending your home in many ways covers that entire spectrum, but the rules are different.
Sure. But what gun owners find frustrating is we don't have time to ask the person who's broken into your house, are you armed and are you here just to steal stuff or are you here to hurt me, right?
Exactly. Which is why I think the law favors home defense. If you're going to get any leeway when it comes to defending your home against an intruder, you probably have to know less about their actual intent before you can use force than in any other scenario because of some of these presumptions
right.
I was talking about. But they aren't absolute, they don't change the scenario enough that if you have reason to believe that the person is not a threat by being incapacitated, or perhaps it was the drunk neighbor that went into the wrong house, or a kid that couldn't possibly hurt you.
Sure.
Once you realize some of those things, you're back to the standard test because the presumption is rebutted, and is that person really a threat? And do I need to defend myself to avoid serious injury or death?
Sure.
And in the Karma case, and now we're talking about Byron Smith, it's pretty clear that there wasn't an actual threat that these guys could articulate.
Yeah. And you talk about the drunk neighbor. So that's a mm-hmm. good way to transition to the Ted Wafer case.
Yes, what a tragic case.
Yeah, so Ted Wafer lives alone in Dearborn Heights in a house that he had owned for 20 years. In that time, he had seen the neighborhood's crime go up. 6 years prior to this incident, he bought a Mossberg pistol grip 12-gauge shotgun that he kept for home defense. He's home on a winter night, a November night, by himself. He fell asleep watching television, and at 4:15 in the morning, he's awoken by this tremendous banging on his doors. He's at a side door and a front door. The banging goes back and forth. He thought there might have been multiple people. He's startled out of sleep. He's terrified. He says the floorboards were shaking. They were banging so loud. He couldn't find his cell phone because his cell phone was in his pants pocket, which he had hung in the bathroom, which is a way of explaining why he didn't call 911 first.
Uh-huh.
So what he did do is he grabbed his shotgun. He went to the front door, and he saw the shadowy figure on the other side of the door.
So here's a guy, the homeowner, the guy that lives there, who has some reason because of other events in the past in the neighborhood to think that he may need a firearm for home defense.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's his response to some of the events in the neighborhood. And here he is awakened from probably a deep sleep in the middle of the night by noises that he can't comprehend. He can't assign a reason to other than somebody banging on his door, apparently trying to get in.
Sure. Like his defense attorney said at trial, who's banging on your door at 3:45 in the morning? They're not there to do good, essentially. But what happens next is a little bit inexplicable, and I don't think at trial he ever explained his actions very well, but he opens the door to confront the person on the other side.
So as I recall the facts of this case, this is the front door
of
his home, and there are actually two doors. There's a solid wooden or metal door, and then on the outside of that, within the door frame, is a separate screen door or storm door.
That's right, it's a screen door, like a metal frame screen door. Mm-hmm.
So when you say he opened the door, essentially it was that first secure door that he opened. And then between him and the person banging was just this flimsy screen door.
Sure. Okay. And here's what he couldn't have possibly known and didn't know, was that this shadowy figure outside of his porch was this 19-year-old named Renisha McBride. She had been drinking and smoking pot with friends earlier in the night. She got in an argument with her friend, drove off, ended up hitting a parked car, probably injuring her head around 1:00 in the morning. And then a witness called the police. By the time the police got there, she had wandered off. So somewhere between 1 in the morning and 3:45, she was wandering around this Dearborn Heights neighborhood, drunk, high, and probably
injured and confused, maybe lost.
Yeah. So prosecutors mm-hmm. suggest that she wasn't trying to break into Wafer's house. She may have mistaken the house for a friend or family, or she was just trying to look for help.
And she may also have known it was 3 or 4 in the morning, thinking, as one in that condition thinks, maybe not very, very smartly, but is thinking, I have to make a lot of noise because it's the middle of the night. I have to get my friend up, sure, to let me in,
or
whoever's there to give me some help.
But when he opens the door, by all accounts, Renisha tried to get in then. You know, like tried to push through the screen. She didn't make it, but made real efforts to get in. And this is when the shotgun goes off, strikes her in her head, kills her instantly. And I say the shotgun went off because when Ted talked to police after they arrived, he told them that he didn't know there was a round in there, suggesting that this was an accident. And we talked about that with this case before, the making statements to try to mitigate the self-defense, right? Mm-hmm. Did Marcus Karma think that he was justified? Yes. Did he make additional statements to try to make it sound more justified? Probably. And that's what Ted Wafer did here. He said, I didn't know there was a round in there.
Well, so that's two big problems.
Yeah.
Not just the fact that the gun discharged, and most guns don't go off accidentally unless they are malfunctioning.
Sure, and in fact, they had a forensic weapon expert look at the shotgun and say that it was incapable of going off.
Yeah, so he pulled the trigger in some fashion.
Yeah.
Whether it was a nervous reaction to something happening at the door that he jerked his finger.
Which I think is probably the most likely scenario.
Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it's clear the trigger got pulled in some fashion, and he at least said to the police that he didn't know that it was loaded. I mean, didn't know that there was a round capable of being discharged.
Right. And so, when we wrote about this, we said there's no such thing as accidental self-defense. And that's one of the big things that sunk him at trial. He got convicted of second-degree murder.
Well, self-defense is a forceful, intentional response to a perceived serious threat of harm or death. So in that sense, you can't accidentally defend yourself in that regard, and there's no such thing as premeditated self-defense. So we've got all of this stuff going here with a guy waking up in the middle of the night claiming he didn't know his gun was loaded, who commits the first, what turned out to be fatal mistake for Ms. McBride, was opening the door, making himself more vulnerable, and in many ways increasing the risk to both of them by confronting her with a gun. Your point, though, really needs to be emphasized, and following this tragic event, this discharge by this guy without a criminal record, who is, as we know, a peaceful neighbor, finds himself now having shot and killed a teenager who probably did pose no threat to him, in fact.
Right.
Now, with the shock of that, he's trying to explain to the police what happened when he probably doesn't even know himself what happened. He's probably trying to put it all together. Why did the gun fire? How afraid was I? How did I get from point A to point B? And wrestling with all of this and make statements that turn out to be critically important and extremely problematic for his lawyer down the road to put on a self-defense claim.
In fact, the judge told the jury that they were allowed to use his false statements, false exculpatory statements, as evidence of guilt. Mm-hmm. And I think that's in large part what contributed to the murder charge. And in this case, this is such an interesting case to talk about because the defense attorney, she was heartbroken at this verdict and said that here's a really decent guy. He's labeled, he's a murderer now, right? But he's not a murderer. Right, I think objectively outside of the court, you look at this, and I think best case scenario, he was scared. He made a bad choice when he opened the door. He was startled. He accidentally pulled the trigger on a shotgun and killed someone who was drunk, mm-hmm. and out of their minds on his front porch in the middle of the night.
He was way over his head too, in that he didn't know how his gun operated. He didn't take the steps necessary to be sure whether there was a shell in the chamber. He didn't take safety precautions so that he didn't accidentally pull the trigger. That's, I think, lack of training, lack of insight. Following the purchase of the gun for home defense, what do you do now? Well, you better know how the gun works and how to operate it under stress. Because if you don't, then you are either going to be the victim because you can't respond quickly and safely to protect yourself, or these kinds of events take place and the gun goes off. You don't really know. You don't know how to respond with the appropriate level of force because you're still uncertain about how your gun works.
Yeah, that's interesting. He was unprepared for the scenario.
Yes.
That he met.
And he compounded that, of course, by a decision that I'm sure he wrestles with every day in prison, which is, why did he open that door? Why did he create a situation where something had to happen? When, had he left the door shut, had he simply retreated to another part of the house, made a more concerted effort to find his phone, if that was the problem, find the phone and call 911, and not use the gun until there was clear evidence that the person was actually gaining entry, I think would have saved her life and in a sense, his
too. And his too. Yeah, he's a 50-some-year-old man who's going to spend at least 17 years in prison.
Sure.
Who told his lawyer, by the way, that he would he wished he could trade places with Renisha.
And there's no reason to doubt the sincerity of that. Imagine the emotional trauma and devastation that comes from being involved in one of these scenarios where you wind up taking another person's life. And frankly, I've been involved in enough self-defense cases where either consulting on cases or personally representing the individual where their actions were completely justified. And they were either not charged because the law enforcement and the prosecutor agreed that their use of deadly force was legally justified, or been prosecuted and then acquitted at trial where the jury found that their self-defense actions were justified. Even in that scenario, when the person is told, yes, you acted legally and appropriately under the circumstance, they are still devastated. They still are suffering these traumatic effects. And I predict for the rest of their life. I don't think there's any way that you completely get over that. And of course, in Ted Wafer's situation, he's second guessing himself every minute of every day. What could he have done differently that would have avoided anything from happening at that front door?
Yeah. I think, and so we have some extreme scenarios here, like Byron Smith and Marcus Karma to a degree, and then you've got these really nuanced scenarios where there's a lot more question marks about guilt, like we have in Ted Wafer. But I think in all these cases, being that they happened at home, when we first started talking about these home invasion cases, or these intruder cases, you came up with a term called forgivable subjectivity. Is that right?
Yes, forgivable subjectivity.
Which I feel is like when you're in your home, there's no place on earth, if we're looking at just location, where you're more justified to use deadly force than
Home. Against an intruder, yes.
And so you, you have this built-in tendency for an investigator or a jury to forgive you for using deadly force. Well, and you have to...
When I say forgivable subjectivity, I'm talking about even beyond what's clearly, lawfully the justified use of force. I think there is a sense of what I'm calling this forgivable subjectivity, even if you turn out to be wrong, even if it's a tragic accident or mistake that you kill someone that has broken into your home by accident.
Sure.
I've known of cases where a homeowner has shot and killed a person in their kitchen in the middle of the night that later turned out to be a relative that had just come to town and had a key. Mm. But because of the circumstances, that homeowner was legally, you know, I don't say justified like it was a good thing, but it's understandable. And that in this instance, law enforcement and ultimately the prosecuting authorities elected not to prosecute the homeowner, even though they'd killed someone clearly that posed no threat to them. So,
well, I want to look at the Karma case, right? And part of this is that he went outside of his house to re-engage in the garage, which I think is legally and technically part of his house, but it was open, so the teenager didn't have to break in to get into the garage. And it's not part of the air-conditioned part of the house, right? I think psychologically, if not legally, it's a little bit different, right? And we call this Curtilage?
Curtilage, yes. Curtilage extends beyond the four walls of the dwelling itself to include garages, even detached garages, and it may include front porch area or backyard, front yard. It's sort of a moving line of sorts, but legally the dwelling extends beyond the home into the curtilage.
I feel that investigators and a jury would have looked at Marcus Carmel a little bit differently if he had stayed in his house. And if the teenager had come into the house through the garage door, we have a completely different scenario now. I feel like someone invading your garage and invading your house might have a same legal threshold, but when it comes to this forgivable subjectivity, there's more of a threat in your house at that point.
Well, I think that's the perception that everyone would have and that a juror would have,
most
too,
importantly,
when they're looking at, let's say, this teenage kid that was looking for beer in the garage, truly believed there was no one home, intended no one home, but thought there might be beer in the fridge inside. The door might even be unlocked, for that matter. Opens the door, takes a couple of steps into the kitchen, and if under the same basic scenario and Karma hadn't announced to the world, including his hairdresser and others, that he was planning to do this kind of thing, if he hadn't adopted a vigilante approach to this issue. But in fact, without all of that, he was a guy at home with that heard some noise and had a gun, and he sees someone coming through the kitchen door. I think if he uses deadly force at that point, it's unlikely that he would be prosecuted, certainly unlikely that he would have been convicted of murder, and maybe acquitted.
Right. And so we have in Ted Wafer, again, curtilage, right?
The front porch.
Front porch. Mm-hmm. And it became important at trial because there's no door to the front porch, right? It's just steps from the street. So Renisha McBride couldn't have broken into the front porch because there's nothing to break through, right? It's open.
No physical barrier.
Uh-huh. Right? And so maybe you could make an argument that she was trying to break in by banging on the door or manipulating that screen door in front. Certainly the defense attorney tried to make that argument. But the fact is she had never crossed a physical barrier threshold, even if the porch, which it is by law in Michigan, considered part of the house, she hadn't broken into it. And there's a threshold that she didn't cross. And like Karma, who leaves the safety of his house to go outside to then re-engage the person, Wafer opens the door and engages. Like he's leaving relative safety and going to a more confrontational position.
Well, you know, we talked a lot about standards when it comes to defending your home, and like we're talking now about extending to the curtilage, but there is this psychological difference, I think, whether you are physically entering into the living space as opposed to being on the porch or out in the garage, and the response of the homeowner is quite different. And I think maybe even though there are certain presumptions that favor the use of force in a home intruder situation, the bottom line litmus test for the finder of fact, the jury, is going to be through the filters of reasonableness. They're going to look at the scenario and say, yes, but, yes, but, yes, but, in its entirety, is it reasonable the way this thing unfolded? And frankly, I think, unlike so many other kinds of criminal cases, in a self-defense case, the test of reasonableness often means that the jury collectively is invited to put themselves in the shoes of the accused. They are looking at this event through the eyes of the person who's sitting across the courtroom from them.
Would I think it'd be reasonable for me to leave my house and go outside?
And I think that's what what it boils down to, is if the juror is saying to himself or herself, and then when they talk about it collectively, would we have done that? And even giving somebody a little leeway based upon that person's background and training and experience and maybe the history of break-ins, factoring all of that in, I think the bottom line for the jury is, would we have done it that way? And if they say, hell no.
Hell no.
Yeah, no.
You're in trouble.
I think so. I think it's right. It's almost that simple. Or it boils down, it distills to that.
So all the nuances in the self-defense cases, the laws, there's curtilage, there's escalation, there's thresholds across. But if a jury doesn't feel it was reasonable, then you're in trouble.
That's been my experience. Yeah.
I think it's interesting. The case that's most murder out of these three that we looked at is Byron Smith. And here we don't have any of the curtilage issues. He's in the deepest part of his home, the basement, the hardest part to get to. He retreated to the furthest crevices, and these intruders happened to meet him there. Interesting to think about, if he hadn't recorded himself telegraphing his rage at these kids, right? And if he hadn't finished them off, right? If it were just the first shots that sent them tumbling down the stairs, and he had left it at that, forget that he didn't call 911, right? That whole case looks different now, right?
Looks completely different.
Even if they'd bled out and they ended up dying anyhow, you know, we talk about a lot that every shot counts.
Yes.
In self-defense. That the first shot that Byron shot was probably justified, even if he had lured them in, right? But they were in his house. They're coming at him. He had hidden in the farthest place away in his house.
If yes, exactly. If that were the truth, that in fact what he was doing was hiding to get away from people that he believed were intruding, and they in a sense found him, at least that's what's going on in his mind. That's some of the forgivable subjectivity. If that's what he believed, that whoever these intruders were had found him or were about to find him and they were coming down the steps, and that he shot each of them and incapacitated them. If it were over at that point, if he had called 911, if he had attempted to provide some first aid of some right. sort, done anything to end it at that point, I think he at least gives his lawyer a chance to argue self-defense and allow a jury to look at that and conclude, may not be what I would have done, but I can't say it was unreasonable. Now, of course, we know from all of those other things, including post-arrest statements and some, that was not his intent. It seemed to be a lying-in-wait ambush with murder in yeah. mind. But I can certainly imagine a slight twist on those facts, a homeowner who's cowering in a room, who's breaking in just to steal something, comes across them by accident with no intent to harm them, and the person reacts to the fact of being discovered and shoots and kills them. I don't see that person being prosecuted.
Right. I think it's a good way to wrap up this conversation. It's worth noting that in all three of these cases, the people shot were not armed. They were all unarmed. And I think what draws us to these cases is that they're, for one reason or another, they're sort of borderline cases, right? These are all, even Byron Smith's, where he murdered these kids, is a borderline case because it was in his home. They invaded his home. They were breaking the law. They were committing a forcible felony. And generally, that is justified, right?
Yes, there's a clear provision in many states where you have the right to use deadly force to prevent a forcible felony. And mm-hmm. most of these states would have a list of what constitutes a forcible felony. You think arson, kidnapping, sexual assault, but burglary is always on the list.
Right. But what makes them even more difficult is that, for the shooter, for sure, is that they ended up being unarmed. If Renisha McBride had a drawn pistol, right? If one of the kids that broke into Byron Smith's house had a gun tucked in his waistband, right? Or the foreign exchange student stealing beer had a gun, or an axe even, right?
Sure.
Or a knife, uh-huh. that all of a sudden everything's different, right?
Yes, I think that it is. Certainly, if there had been some way to articulate a threat, in all of these instances, nobody bothered to wait. No, waited long enough to see if, in fact, they were armed. They shot them under these other circumstances.
Yeah, and people I talk to, that, why should you have to bother to wait? They're in my house. Right, it's easy to conceal a weapon. How do I know that they're unarmed? I can never know for sure.
That's exactly right, and I think that's probably the policy behind those laws that give a homeowner extra protection in defending oneself against an intruder. That you don't have to wait quite as long. You don't have to see the gun in their hand. Once they have entered your property, the presumption is that they are there to do harm.
Right.
However, as I mentioned early on, that's not a presumption that extends through absolute use, the right to use deadly force.
Yeah.
If that dynamic changes at all, and by virtue of the circumstances, you realize they're not a threat to you, then you no longer have the right to use force under the circumstances.
So, and I think if there's a lesson here, there's lots of lessons here, but a good takeaway as we wrap this up would be that in each of these cases, there are multiple opportunities to de-escalate, even the home invasion, right? With Marcus Karma, he didn't have to go outside into the garage. He could have made sure the indoor door to his garage was locked, could have called the police. He had a shotgun in his hand. He could have waited until he started seeing that door get splintered before he fired.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
With Byron Smith, right? He had already retreated to the bottom, but he was planning for them to come down, and he fired more than he needed to. He had plenty of time to announce his presence to the kids. They probably would have run off if he said, "Hey, I know you're up there. I got a rifle. And I've called the cops," and then had called the cops. Very likely that whole confrontation's avoided, the kids run off.
If he had said that, and they continued down the stairs at that point, that tells him that they're there for reasons other than just stealing something. If they know he's there, he announces his presence and says,
"And they still want a confrontation."
And they still want a confrontation. I think that's clear enough,
right,
whether or not they have a gun or a knife or other weapon in their hand at that point, because now they're in his house. They've, by their actions or failing to react to his attempt to control the situation, continue to be aggressive.
Sure. And then Ted Wafer could have made a bigger effort to find his phone to call 911. He could have at least waited in his house for the door to come off the hinges. He had a shotgun in his hand too.
Well, you know, in Smith and Karma, it's almost like they were looking for an opportunity to justify the use of their firearms and to shoot these kids that had been breaking into the place. Wafer, I think, was just a guy who immediately was over his head. I don't think in any way he was trying to look for an opportunity to shoot this person. I think he just made one series of bad decisions after another. And part of it maybe because it was the middle of the night, other because of perhaps lack of training or understanding or an appreciation that really the last thing he wants to do is to provoke a confrontation, but rather exercise any of those other options he had for a much safer alternative.
So the mindset should be that we want to avoid a situation where we have to shoot somebody in our house at all costs, save for the safety of the family that lives there, right?
I think people feel that their house is so protected and so sacred that that gives them the right to shoot anybody that crosses the threshold. And yet that sometimes gets emotionally confused with protecting yourself from invaders. Those are the guys, I think, that shoot the burglar in the back as he's going out of the house carrying the television.
Right.
Or that believes you can shoot and kill somebody for a property type crime. And there's very few jurisdictions where that's entirely possible. I don't think it's ever worth it, frankly.
Right.
To use deadly force for defense of property.
Right. And then there's in each of these cases, there are barriers and thresholds that were crossed before force was used. And I think one of the lessons is when you've purchased the weapon to protect your home, that you've talked about, you need to know how to use it so nothing happens accidentally. Mm-hmm. And then you have to imagine all the steps that you take that are reasonable to protect your home up to and including the use of the weapon.
Yeah, the notion of avoiding it, I think, is not to suggest that you should be a coward or that you should give in, but avoiding any lethal confrontation also saves that big part of your life where you spend agonizing over what happened, even if you were completely right.
Right.
So instead of taking the chance, if you have some reasonable way to avoid the confrontation, by all means, my suggestion is. And if you don't, and you absolutely have to defend your life or the life of someone else, be sure you know what you're doing. Be sure you know how your gun works. Be sure you know what to say and do with the police, because they're coming if you fire the gun. And of course, know the law so you know where the boundaries are, that you don't cross over and, in a sense, take an otherwise innocent act and turn it into a crime.
Those are good last thoughts. The next three parts in our series are going to focus on shootings that happened in or around cars and often called road rage incidents. And we're going to talk a little bit more about when, your car is kind of like your castle. It's a place where you're presumed to be safe. But
not only is it in that sense kind of like your castle, but some of those laws in various states that protect certain conduct in the home also extend to cars. And we'll talk about that too, but next time.
Yeah, sounds good.
Thanks, Sean. Nice talking with you. This is In Self-Defense. I'm Don West, National Trial Counsel for CCW Safe. Thank you.
See you next time.